Session number 11338, Reel 7.
Group Captain Ingle, Reel 7.
But despite all that, it had its funny side. I can remember one incident at Luckenwalde. There, I think I said, we had the Norwegian General Staff with us. And the arrangements at Luckenwalde were even cruder than most, because the loose seats, instead of being flat and level, they were tilted, so you couldn't really sit on them. And there were rats occupying the building quite extensively, so it was not very pleasant if you had to go out there in the dark. But when the Germans had left, we got a lot of refugees in, who, you know, we had to look after. We had a lot of Dutch refugees, and both sexes, complete families, in fact. And one morning when I was doing my liaison job, I was approached by a highly indignant Norwegian brigadier. And I couldn't understand what he should be getting excited about, but he explained that he'd been having his morning constitutional in this loo, and a large Dutch lady had come and taken the next door seat. And he didn't think this was right and proper. But he was even more indignant when apparently the lady insisted on opening a conversation with him. And he thought this was most irregular as a very senior officer to be placed in this situation. And what was I going to do about it? Well, of course, it was a bit difficult since there was only one blue block in that particular compound for everybody who happened to be in it, which contained Poles, Norwegians, the RAF air crew, and any spare space filled up with Dutch and other assorted families. So that we had to assure him we hoped it wouldn't happen again and let it go at that. But the loo question, it's the thing I remember most about Germany. And if I have a nightmare, this is the sort of thing, this always recurs in it. But I can't think of anything else very much significant. The Germans as a race can be very impossible people, can be very charming people, very pleasant people, and very considerate people. Some of them were extremely considerate. There was one man, he was Glimbitz. Now, he was the Stamsfeldwebel in the North Camp at Luckenwalde.
What was his name?
Glimbitz.
How do you spell that?
Glimwitz, I think. He was a Stamsfeldwebel. He was the sergeant major. He was a big man, bull-necked, thick, substantial, looked a typical brutal sort of fellow. And he did his job effectively. He did a difficult job to do. He did it effectively. But he was very fair with everybody, and he was highly respected. And some time after the war, when I was stationed in Holland, I had occasion to go up and see a friend in Berlin. And the first person I saw in the MT section in Gatow was friend Glimwitz. The RAF had taken him on as head of their motor transport in Gatow. And he may still be there, though he would be quite an old man now. But they could be very good. They could be quite impossible. Quite impossible. But there's no doubt about it. They were damn good soldiers. And but the trouble is, they could be very ruthless as soldiers.
Well, did you do anything about the people in the camp, you know, the Germans in command of your camp, regarding the sort of war criminal aspect? Were you Well, able we, to identify any?
Well, we did, in fact, as I said, produce all this box of information which we brought back, and some of it was used. I think various people were identified, but the people that the RAF had the strongest beef against, well, it was more than a beef, were, of course, the Gestapo, who, on Hitler's orders, murdered 50 of the people who were in the Great Escape, quite deliberately. It wasn't a question of being shot while escaping arrest or anything like that. It was deliberate murder, and the people they murdered were some of the finest people we could have, you know, there were. There really were some very, very fine people were killed. And that really did sour relations. And I think the Germans themselves, like as I said earlier, I think the average German professional soldier was very ashamed of that. But
yes, but also regarding your delayed repatriation, mm-hmm. Do you understand that better now? You know, in the light of information that has come out about the Soviet claims to the repatriation of their own nationals.
Well, there must have been some motive, and thinking about it, it must have been something like that. Just as the Germans thought they'd try and get us to down into Moosburg to hold us more or less as bargaining counters down there, I wouldn't be at all surprised if they if the Russians were doing the same thing for some purpose, but it certainly wasn't made clear to us there, and I don't think it was probably made clear to the people at our sort of level in the Russians at our sort of level. They may have been working on some instructions, but there's no doubt about it. We were deliberately prevented from coming back when we should have come back, because we could have been home weeks earlier. So I think you're probably right. We could have been regarded as pawns too, and I think it's probably as well we'd resisted all efforts to shift us down to Odessa, because we'd have been in an even more impossible position. It's not that we'd been in an impossible position, but of course no one would know where we were, because we'd not been able to get any. Once we moved to Luckenwalde, of course, there was no mail, no letters, no nothing at all. And as far as we disappeared off the face of the earth. We were at Sagan, where I wouldn't say, you know, even regular letters, but at least there was some contact. But and of course the Swiss knew where we were and that sort of thing. But when we got to Luckenwalde, they didn't. And of course, if we'd departed from Luckenwalde and headed east, we literally would have disappeared. And whether we'd have reappeared again, I think it would be very much dependent on what the Russians did. From what I've seen and from what I've heard and everything else, I think it's strongly possible that we were perhaps going to be kept as pawns in this thing. There must have been some reason for it, because I can't see it helped them at all keeping us there. I mean, we're just an embarrassment. Their armies have got up to Berlin, and we've got to be there, and we've got to be looked after to some extent, although we were looking after ourselves quite, for you know, most of our requirements. But, no, it left an unpleasant taste in your mouth, and quite frankly, I had more respect for the Germans than I had for the Russians, really. I mean, at least within their limitations, they did try to conform. I mean, our rations, such as they were, came to Luckenwalde up to the day before the Germans left. And it must have been very difficult for them, because they got the Russians advancing on very quickly. And the Germans themselves, you see, when the Russians were practically on top of us, or were on top of us, there was a pocket of Germans in woods nearby still fighting like mad, because they were sending very threatening messages to us and saying that if we had a light or anything at night or made any sort of murmur, they'd just open up on us with mortars. And we weren't very keen on that, because we'd had quite a bit. I can recall coming back from Klosterzimmer. We'd been looking at the accommodation there one day, and we came down a road and there was just firing going on over the top of us. So they had to do quite a lot of mopping up. It was quite hazardous. And it was a great relief to be out of it, because you're in such a helpless position.
So after the war, you know, when you resumed a full-time career with the RAF, did it surprise you that the Russians, I suppose I am right in saying this, they were the enemy, or posed as the enemy, during the Cold War period?
Oh, without shadow of doubt about it. I mean, there was such an enormous great machine, military machine built up there, and we'd been watching it from 1943, where they turned the tables. We could watch it in the German papers. We got all these German papers with all the maps, the fronts, and we were watching. We were all the pundits in the camp. We had some experts, particularly Poles and people like that, who knew the country and the area. They analysed the situation, and you saw this great machine building up and rolling the Germans back. And of course it was up to some enormous size by the end of the war. And the thing we could never understand is why the Allies didn't keep going. Two things we could never understand was why at the end of 1944, when the Allies appear to have got themselves in a position where they could have just poured straight through, they appeared to hesitate, because we confidently expected, it was home for Christmas, 1944. We expected that. And we couldn't understand this, because they were doing so well. And the other thing we couldn't understand is why, when they got so very close to us, only 30 miles away, before the Russians arrived, why they didn't keep rolling and roll straight up to Berlin. But they pulled up. Well, there were Americans opposite us, you see, at Wittenberg, I think it is, on the Elbe, the Americans were. They came up to the Elbe and stopped, bang. Because we were getting a plot of how they were coming, and we were absolutely horrified when they appeared to get to this point and just stop. See, the people who'd gone to the other camp, the other half of Stalag Luft III, they wound up in a naval camp somewhere near Hamburg. And, of course, Montgomery's men arrived up there and went beyond that, so that they were all picked up by the British. But, I wasn't surprised, really, the way things developed after the war. I think when you've got a machine like that, which is commanded as ruthlessly as it was by Stalin, it wasn't unexpected. But I don't know, probably if you look at it, it at least crystallized positions, so the world was able to advance again and get itself re-established, albeit the communists did it one side of the Iron Curtain and we did it the other. At least everybody knew where they stood. And there wasn't a sort of vacuum left in the middle of Europe. So perhaps when people look back on the situation, they'll say, well, perhaps the Cold War was inevitable and in fact wasn't a bad thing. At least the balance was struck, maintained, and that meant you've had peace in Europe.
rather different today then, with the curtain down.
Well, I think
or curtain up.
If you look at today, we're reverting back to where we were in 1930. And I think it's a very dangerous situation. I think we're in greater danger now than we ever were in the during the Cold War period for this reason. There may not be the immediate threat of nuclear attack, but I think the situation could... Well, Europe's going to be disrupted, I'm quite sure now, for quite a number of years. And when you get disruption like that, you can never tell what hot-headed action someone's going to take. I suppose we've just got to live through it now and see what happens. But I think there's not the balance in Europe that there was. And when it gets out of balance, I think this is when you can look for trouble.
What is it? May 1990. It's nearly 50 years on, isn't it, to the Battle of Britain. I wonder how you feel, sort of looking back on those 50 years and that experience you had in World War II, and particularly the Battle of Britain.
Yes. Well, I suppose in retrospect now, you always tend to look on the rosy side when you look at things in retrospect. I think now, I was born in the middle of the First World War, I've lived through the second, or I survived the second one, and some of the more interesting bits of it. So, I wouldn't have changed anything, quite frankly. Now, as far as the Battle of Britain's concerned, well, when we were discussing this earlier, I said we weren't really aware that we were fighting what was a crucial battle at the time. We were just doing what we'd joined up to do. But I must say, since I was very disappointed the way things went, when the war ended, and I must say at times I used to think, well, why did we bother? But then, since we weren't aware of what we were doing, or the significance of what we were doing at the time, I suppose that's pretty relevant. But I must say at times I wondered whether we'd really taken advantage of the successes that had eventually been achieved in the war and the way we'd conducted ourselves after the war. I think the expertise and the energy with which the war was conducted, and my own view is, despite all the criticism and everything else, there were quite a number of failures and so on, there's no doubt about it. It's the end result that counts, and we won. And I think there was a considerable amount of real expertise displayed to achieve that situation. But I don't think this was continued after the war. And certainly for the rest of the 40s after the war, it seemed to me the country was going the wrong way. It wasn't getting down to the real problems of rebuilding what was a badly shattered country, let's face it. We were more concerned with people's personal condition and position and so on, and everybody had to be cushioned. During the war, you took what came. I look at the people in London, look at the way they stood up to what was going on, look at the people in Coventry and Plymouth and Portsmouth and Liverpool and so on. They took tremendous punishment, but you didn't hear a lot of moaning about it. And after the war, people seemed to think everything would be offered to them on a plate. They didn't realise that the people during the war had suffered very much to even be in the position where they were free and could make their own choices. And I think this obtains today. If you look at the situation today, people are whining and whinging all the time, far too preoccupied with their own personal position and their own personal comforts and there's too little regard for the country. There's too little regard for what should be the real aims of a country if you're going to be successful. It's all too easy for everybody now. It's all far too easy. People don't have to fight for anything. And then, of course, the fact that there's been nothing for the spirited young bloods to... well, there's been no way they could dissipate their energy since the war. I mean, this is the longest period we've had without a war. I don't know. Must be ever, I think. 40-odd years without a major war is quite an achievement, certainly for the British. And you really wonder whether this isn't the cause of all the hooliganism, the lack of self-control, the lack of self-discipline that we're suffering from at the moment. And until there's some reason why people should discipline themselves, I think we shall continue to have the troubles that we're having. We learned a lot during the war. The trouble is the modern generation isn't learning a lot from the war and from what had to be done to get us in the position we're in today. Nobody's looking for gratitude, but at least you'd expect there'd be an appreciation of what would what was done and the value of it. Instead, there is, you see, even more and more now, a denigration of the people who achieved the results that were achieved. And I cannot see, however good, bad or indifferent our leaders were during the war, they achieved a result, a satisfactory result at the end. And to my mind, that should be their epitaph, not what's being produced now to denigrate practically everybody who had a major role to play during the war. Sad, sad, very sad.
Well, you know, talking of one of the main leaders, you know, Winston Churchill, I understand that you represented the RAF at his funeral, or the Battle of Britain pilots.
Yes, there were 13 of us. There was Al Dear, as an air commodore, he led this little band, and there were 12 group captains. And we headed Churchill's funeral procession. Oh, we were very honoured to do it. But by God, it was bitterly cold. I can recall at some unearthly hour in the morning standing on the... We were right at the head of the procession, so that we formed up at the corner of Trafalgar Square, at the corner of the Strand, well, the Strand and Whitehall there. And the wind blew very cold around that corner. We watched all these people going down to St. Paul's. And then we led the procession along. Well, there was a police band in front of us, or some mounted police in front of us, that's right. So that we led the thing, and but we were there when gun carriage with the coffin was outside Westminster Abbey, so you can tell the length of the procession. And when the procession halted at St. Paul's, we were in fact in front of Cannon Street Station. And we waited in front of Cannon Street Station until the service was over, and then we advanced down towards the tower, and we broke off the tower. It was quite an occasion, quite an occasion.
Yes, it's interesting that the Battle of Britain pilots were chosen to lead it, isn't it?
Yes. Yes, I suppose it is. It was a very great honour. We felt it so, anyhow. It's,
Did you feel you had a special place, you know, in Winston Churchill?
Well, we didn't necessarily feel we were entitled to a special place. We felt we'd been given one. And a dozen of us, some of them are still alive. Oh, about half of them are still alive, I think, the people who were there. But funny, they were all people we knew. I mean, it was... all the fighter people, it's funny, they're sort of rather close association that the fighter people have. You knew all the other people there. You just picked up 13 and everybody knew one another. Quite amazing. No, it was an occasion. It was quite an occasion. But then he was quite a man, wasn't he?
Are you participating in anything, you know, this year?
Oh, well, I'm going up to the reception at the Guildhall, and we're sincerely hoping the Queen Mother will be there because she's the patron of the Battle of Britain Fighter Association. She came the last time on the 40th occasion, and we're hoping to see her again this time. But, it's 50 years on for us, it's 90 years on for her. But I'm sure she'll come if she can do it. We're being entertained at the Guildhall again. We shall be there. We're then being entertained by the Savoy. Dinner and dance at the Savoy, but I can't see we aged parties doing much dancing, quite frankly. Anyhow, it'll be nice to meet some old friends. There are quite a number of people coming from all over the world. The association is busy trying to make sure that anybody from overseas who was involved gets back by some means or other. And so I think they're going to be... There'll certainly be more than two-thirds, I think, the surviving pilots. Would it be as many as that? No, it'll probably only 50% because we're taking our wives. At the Guildhall, and I think... The attendance at Fighter Command is going to be a very high one. That's that we go to Fighter... at 11 Group, at least. We go to 11 Group headquarters at Bentley... what am I talking about? We go to Fighter Command headquarters at Bentley Priory annually on the nearest Saturday. We should be there, and I don't know, it's the 15th or the 16th, you know, whatever that Saturday is. And I think that's probably going to be the biggest attendance we've ever had. Because I think for a lot of people, you see, who are overseas and that sort of thing, it'll be a final fling. So it's going to be very interesting. Then there's the church, then there's on the Saturday afternoon, there's a parade down the mile and an assembly at Buckingham Palace, but I can't attend that. I'm not physically fit enough to do it. My spine is seriously damaged, and I can't walk for any great distance, and I can't stand for any great length of time, so I shan't be attending that. Much as I'd like to, but there we are. It's not my... Afraid it's not going to be my scene on that day, but I think everybody is showing a remarkable interest in the fact that it is the 50th anniversary. It's very encouraging. Hope it raises a lot of money for the RAF Benevolent Fund.
Yes, I hope so too.
Yes.
And thank you very much indeed, Group Captain Ingalls, you know, for sparing me so much of your time.
It's been a great pleasure to talk to you.
I had no idea your back was bad.
You're such a good listener.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.